Welcome to the Seasons of Sobriety podcast. This is a podcast where you can join in the journey of other recovering alcoholics and addicts. You'll be on the road with them as you listen to how each person came into recovery and how they persevered through times of anger, sadness, fear, and joy. I am your host, Howard M. I am here to share my own experience as well as the experience of other recovering brothers and sisters. I am so grateful you have decided to join me today. This episode features Seth P. from Kingston, Ontario. Seth has been sober since April 12th of 2010. Some of the insights in his story are the following. Creating a system of accountability for himself in early recovery was invaluable. The transformation from someone who looked at the steps and did not want a relationship with God to a man who decided to dedicate his life to God and others by becoming a pastor. Service work in the program allowed him to meet people who are serious about attending meetings and helping others. The inevitable journey of grief demonstrated to him that there was an abundance of people to support him in that process. Here now is my interview with Seth P. I welcome everyone to the Seasons of Sobriety podcast. I am here with Seth P. from Kingston, Ontario. Seth's sobriety date is April 12th of 2010. And Seth, welcome to Seasons of Sobriety podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like you to go back to maybe March, April, or February, or the time frame about 2010, right before you're coming into the program or thinking about entering into a 12-step recovery, and just talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, it's looking at January of 2010 for myself. I was still a professional comedian. And I was being sent on a six-week tour of Eastern Canada, starting in Niagara Falls. But my addiction really got in the way at this point. And I burnt that bridge by not getting on the plane and not showing up to not a gig in Niagara Falls in the beginning of a six-week Eastern tour, all because of addiction. And so... what happened afterwards was a long depressed time where I stayed in my apartment in Vancouver, in downtown Vancouver, British Columbia. And not a lot was going on for me. People were kind of calling to check up on me. My dad was popping by the house just to do welfare checks at that point. And then what would you know? The 2010 Olympics, the long celebrated, anticipated, huge celebration in my hometown was going to happen. And I was completely miserable through that whole time. And if you think about it, the end of February is a huge, huge, huge day in Canadian history. That February 2010, the last day of the Olympics, when Canada won the gold medal at home in overtime. And I was wrought with anxiety as I walked down the streets of Vancouver and watched people celebrating. And it was the exact, like, I was terrified inside because the levels of anxiety and self-loathing were so high at that point. I was just not comfortable with who I was. And so then... that led into March of 2010, which was another scraping on the bottom type of month. I just was bumping up against rock bottom on a daily basis and not loving my life and not leaving my apartment very much. For an extrovert, I was really staying behind those closed blinds and looking out onto the street. I'm lucky that I had family that had suggested that they would pay for treatment so that when I ended up on my last bender, which was the first 10 days of April, and I was physically sick and in deep mental distress. So I was laid out on my couch and I was very physically ill from the substances that I was using. And I feared for my life. And at that point, I'd never been to AA. So what I did was I called my mother because she'd put that offer out Christmas 2009. And she said, if you ever need help, the family will help you out. She met me at a Denny's the next day. And then I was in the hospital for 7 days. And after that, they got me out of the hospital and they got me into treatment.
Very nice.
So getting into treatment was the very first exposure that I had to AA. And so I went into the lecture hall and I remember they said, yeah, it's your first day, but you're going to go to lecture. And that's when I saw the steps on the wall and I'd never seen them before. And I surveyed them like a lot of people do and counted how many times it mentioned God and all that. And that was an objection that I really kept to myself. I knew I really needed to be in that treatment center and I saw it as a medical facility. And I thought that this was going to be a medical process. I'd always tried to put my trust in that side of things. And I didn't really understand that there might be other ways of dealing with this as well in, you know, kind of in concert with medical help and psychological help. But definitely I was stubborn enough to say, no way for that God thing right now. And that was my conviction through the first 8 weeks of staying in treatment. And during that time, I went through step 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. They put you through that. You work on step 1 for about 4 weeks while you're in there. Starting to meet people from the community that had some sobriety in them. And honestly, that part of the program for a newcomer to meet people that have maybe 1 year or 2 year, you know, when they would pop by the treatment center and go to the Friday night meeting, that really seemed attainable and it seemed like an attractive lifestyle to me. They were all mostly people under the age of 30 that would come into the treatment center because they'd relocated to the city that the treatment center was in. And I had failed so many times before because I never found a community really to attach myself to. And that was a huge missing component to this because what they said to me seemed to make sense. And so in the whole part of admitting powerlessness and working on step one, it was a we kind of situation. I needed to be able to hear other people's stories and say, well, that's almost identical to my experience. So I felt comfortable as I worked through that, but in treatment I really think they quickly go through 2, 3, 4, and 5. And they recommend when you leave that you should do a more thorough job.
Okay.
But the interesting thing is after 8 weeks of treatment, they offered me another 3 months.
Okay. weren't quite ready to leave yet.
No. So, you know, I was 29 and they saw my history. They saw, okay, you've been hospitalized 4 times since you were 25 years old. And they said, you've had psychiatric issues related to drug and alcohol use since you're 17 years old. If you continue this way and you don't treat this now, you have a high probability of dying of one of numerous things related to addiction. And my family echoed that. They said, we believe this to be true. We've been worried about it. We've been concerned about this for 12 years. The doctor at the treatment center echoed that. My counselor echoed that. But then I had all these people that I had met, you know, people who hung around the treatment center that had 1 or 2 years. And then other folks that were in the treatment center that were kind of really identifying with sobriety and that were working the program that were young like me. And they were saying, yeah, it is a good idea for yourself. We've heard your story, Seth. We heard it in group therapy. We know what you've been through and we want you to live. And so I said, okay, I'll take the extra three months. That's fine. It's being offered to me. My family's going to take care of the cost. And that investment of time was life-changing. There was a chance for me to come and go, to take afternoons and be out on my own and out in the community. And whenever I work with sponsees now in their early periods, I just always recommend them to slow things down and take an early pace mm-hmm. at things for me. Because if I was to give myself an honest assessment at that time in my sobriety, even though I'd been introduced to step 2, 3, 4, and 5, I was still at a step 1 moment still. I think I was still building the foundation. Mm-hmm. So I got structure. I got to do more group therapy. We did a weekly step group run by a counselor, and I found my first sponsor.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This was when I was going to meetings 4 times, 4 times a week, sometimes more, and meeting more and more people like me. And it was amazing because we were in Nanaimo, British Columbia, so out looking on the Pacific Ocean on an island. And I hadn't really ever in the 10 years prior, done things like appreciate a sunset over the water, and the Friday night meeting in Nanaimo is right on the waterfront, right in Departure Bay. And you'll see the sun dip below the horizon right there from the meeting room. And, it was amazing to just be able to be like, hey, yeah, things are looking better right now. And so I soldiered on. I followed every suggestion. And when it came to people, sort of challenging me and saying, like, you're really stubborn about the higher power piece of things.
Okay.
And you got all these problems right now. So I did have a lot of hangups in this period of my sobriety, this early first 5 months. And one of them was, I got to rethink what I'm doing career-wise. How am I going to get a job?
Hmm.
And I'm worried about it. I just worry and worry and worry. I guess, you might be able to relate.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. For an alcoholic, a trick question is, what do you do for a living?
Yeah, exactly.
What do you mean now, or what I used to do, or what am I about to do, or what? I get you.
So I was looking at changing over my entire career, and I just worry about it. I start talking to my counselors, to my friends, and they're like, Seth, you're always worrying about that. I'd be worrying about, what am I going to do? What am I going to do with my, what am I going to do for finding a place to live? Where am I going to live when this is over? And like, you don't have to worry about it right now. Why are you worrying about it? Or I'm having conflicts with other people, other patients in the treatment center. People are like, why do you have to worry about it? Why does what they think of you matter so much? But it did. And I was hanging on to that. So one counselor said, well, why don't you just pray for those people and for those situations and see what happens? And that was probably the first action that I took that led me to believe that there's something to the whole higher power part of the program. Mm-hmm. And that opened up the door for me because I got a job in about 3 weeks, of looking. And that was the job that I had for the first 3 years of sobriety. And I met great people that worked there, and they supported me through my sobriety. I worked in the copy and print center of a Staples, so
yep.
I was a comedian that was performing all up and down the West Coast of North America and in Canada. And I had a promising career that I'd torched, and I had to come to terms with standing behind a counter and trying to figure out how to, scan some person's photos to their liking and be patient about it. So it was a huge change.
Yeah.
But well, I prayed for it and my prayer was answered. So that happened. And for those people that I had conflicts with, then some of them became my friends, mm-hmm. And so things started to just fall into place when I stop trying to mess around and figure all this stuff out and really try and get my hands in there and do my will.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And the word surrender comes to mind as you're talking. Mm-hmm. Just whatever it is, you know, what am I going to do? What do people think? Where am I going to go? Well, what would you be worrying about if you didn't worry about that stuff?
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. And so I was presented this awesome opportunity when I finished treatment. A guy who had some time in the program got together seven guys and he said, every Sunday night, we're going to do the steps. Hmm. We're going to work our way through. It'll take as long as it takes. And everyone who signed up, all seven of us, we stuck through until the following spring. So from September to the following spring, we went and we went through every step.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a proper step, 4 and 5. I felt like I really was able to build on the work that I did with the chaplains in the treatment center when I spent 4 or 5 days doing my first fourth. And it was absolutely amazing that I was able to be supported by another group of guys, because I was living in a sober living house and they said, well, we'll just do it in your living room, you know?
Yeah.
And so I made another nice, logical, small step in my life by moving just down the street from my treatment center, you know? And I said, you know, I need to be able to plan things that will hold me accountable.
Yeah.
Because I still have an issue trusting myself. And I've always done that. I've always, you know, worked with sponsor people in the program to hold me accountable. And that was so important because there was so much that I wanted to change from my life prior, you know?
Yeah, I think one of the many things that has been difficult over the years for me is being accountable to someone. In other words, when they ask how I was doing, to just not, you know, to just be straight with them rather than, you know, fine or not much, you know, everything's okay. And one guy told me, he said, listen, you know, one of the ways you have true relationships is you have some passion in that relationship. And the way you get passion is you stop, you know, being indirect with people and lying to them, really.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're doing okay, all right, you know, people don't, you know, feel a need to connect with someone who doesn't want to connect with them. And that's why you feel a little isolated or on the outside of things, is because you're not willing to be accountable and mm-hmm. say, this is what's going on.
Yeah. And I had a system of accountability, and yeah. that is the greatest suggestion that I could give anyone who is in their first year: build an entire system of accountability. Because not only was I in a sober house, I had a sober house next door. I had a sober house 4 blocks down the street. I was living in a 10 block radius that had about 5 sober living houses with about 15 or 25 young recovering addicts. And it was just, it is recovery town. That is a town of 80,000 that has a quite a large treatment center. And it was just the best logical move for me to take things simple, work a simple job, and just work on myself. Mm-hmm. You know, get out of this race to succeed and become famous as a comedian and just build myself up. And so at one point someone was like, hey, you know, do you want to maybe drive me to church? I'm in treatment center. You want to take me to, you know? And so I started investigating spirituality outside of the program, and that didn't really necessarily work with them. But eventually at one point, you know, the career that I'm working now happened to just stumble my way as I started to, you know, like investigate the spiritual side of the program, mm-hmm. which now today I am, you know, an ordained pastor, and it's my career. It's what I do. And, you know, it's something that people identify me as in the program, as a clergy person that can do steps 4 and 5 with you. And, mm-hmm. And so the way that all happened was just one day a clergy person was speaking,
mm-hmm.
I heard what they were talking about. And they were talking about the work that they did in prison and how they were able to relate to the people on a way that showed them absolute equality, that all the divisions that you see inside a prison between what you were offending for or the gangs that you're a part of, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter when you come and you talk to the chaplain. And that was the experience that I felt when I was in treatment, when I met the chaplain. And I always seemed to identify with chaplains. So what happened shortly after I took my first year was somehow higher power revealed to me that, look, maybe this is something that you need to explore. And I wish that I could say that at that point I was like, oh yeah, absolutely, I'll take the logical steps. Yeah.
Sign me up. Where do I, you know, I'll be in front of the class every day.
Yeah, definitely not. it took me 2 years before I even started my master's degree to become a clergy person. So for the next 2 years, it was kind of running away from higher power and that understanding of my higher power's will, you know? But those years were formative years of my life. I was given an opportunity with the treatment center that I went to. They were opening up their own sober living house. Mm-hmm. And I caught wind of that. And I'd been in one sober living house for about 10 months. And so I just called up the continuing care supervisor at the treatment center. And I was really into helping still suffering alcoholics. I thought that's part of the work that I want to do in my life. I want to find a way I can start doing it now. Mm-hmm. And like many things for alcoholics, you know, I started thinking something and suddenly a door opened up where I caught wind that they're opening up this sober house. They need someone with a year clean to be there to make sure that people clean and they're home for curfew. They'll give you a deal on rent. Mm-hmm. And I said, I could do that for a year. And so what I did was I called them up and then they said no. And then they called me back 2 days later. They couldn't find anyone and they said yes. Mm-hmm. So I told the landlord of my sober living house that I was moving. And he said, you know what, when you walked in here, I knew you were going to be telling me that you're moving out. And I'm glad you are. I'm glad that you've had this journey with us and you're moving on to better things, because it doesn't always work out this way, you know? And so then you think it would just be great that I would move into this sober living house and be the house monitor. And then things would just be, you know, I didn't really think of the taxing side of that position.
That you're living with a bunch of alcoholics and addicts? Well, why would you think about that?
Yeah, I know. I just thought, hey, Seth, you have the skills, man. You're working the spiritual side of the program. You're going to move in there. It's going to be six recovering alcoholics that have under 2 years clean, some of them fresh out of treatment, some of them fresh back from a relapse.
What could possibly go wrong, right?
What could possibly go wrong? And absolutely everything went wrong. You know, the first day I moved in, someone failed a urine test.
Yeah.
And that's where I really realized a huge part of defects of character that were following me around. And that it was, I don't know, for some people, there just seems to be the one major one out of them all that you really run into. And mine has to do with my perception that I believe that I can control people.
Oh. Okay.
You know, I seem to think that with the appropriate wording or maybe the appropriate tone of voice that I can convince anyone to do my will.
Yeah.
And I found that out real quick in that sober living environment, that I was not going to be listened to by everyone who moved in there. And they were in a different place sometimes and sobriety wise than I was. And so, it became very frustrating. And, you know, eventually, you know, maybe about 3 months in, there'd been four people that had been removed from the sober living house. And that really always kind of disrupted the house. And my sponsor, you know, he wasn't really helping me along with this too much. And what happened with that was during this time, I started to find out that my sponsor was dealing with some stuff. And he was great, very helpful, super involved in recovery and in that first year and in that first step group in my first sober house. But then some parts of his life started to get a little bit chaotic, and people started to say, you know what, that's none of your business. What's going on with him? You can't control him. You can't control that. And you might want to start thinking about getting a new sponsor. And at this point in my recovery, where I was in my early part of my second year, I was doing a lot of service work. And there was some guy at these service meetings that was always around. We started identifying. He had more time in. And I switched sponsors real quick, and that was the best thing that I could do. And he started working with me about, he just kept saying, man, what other people think of you, it's none of your business. That was his message to me for 7 years. You know, it would always come back to that in the work that we would do together. And we take other people through the steps over that 7 year relationship that we had as sponsor sponsee. It would always come back to my issue with control. Yeah.
Yeah. You remind me of a time when I was, you know, a similar personality or character defect. And someone came up to me and I said, well, you know, I like to be in control. And he says, oh, I see. So you like to surround yourself with people who you think are weaker than you so you can manipulate them. I said, well, when you put it like that, that doesn't sound as pretty. He said, right, I don't think it should sound pretty. That's why I put it that way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that's what it was. He says, you know, he says, if you keep surrounding yourself with people who you believe are weaker than you, you'll never grow. You'll, you'll think you're in, you know, King Turd of Crap Mountain. And that's what you are. And you'll never aspire to be better than what you are, because you don't have to, because no one's going to challenge you. And, of course, here was someone who was stronger than me, and I welcomed the opportunity for him to help me be someone who would be stronger rather than, you know, dominate people that I thought were weaker than me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what I wanted to do. And I think it's really interesting what higher power had in store for me in terms of learning about control, because that very year after, you know, going red in the face, explaining to people the rules of that sober living house, higher power sent me two issues that I had absolutely no control over. My stepfather had terminal cancer, and a friend of someone who had time in the program, who was a wife of someone who had time in the program, who was well respected in my home group as someone who would be a supporter out on cake night, who'd have us over for coffee and everything. About 3 weeks after my stepfather got diagnosed with terminal cancer, this 42-year-old woman also got diagnosed with terminal cancer. Two very important positive forces in my recovery. People that, you know, my stepfather was a huge force in me, getting me into treatment, supporting my mom through that period. And it was just like, then I knew I only had about a year left with both of them. And they died only about 3 weeks apart from each other. And that whole grief piece is one of the hardest things for alcoholics to really encounter the first time around in sobriety, I think.
Can you talk more about that? Because I think you're right. And like you said, this is obviously something you can't control when a loved one, you know, gets sick. And where and how do we grieve? Can you talk about that, please?
Well, the first part of it is, I think that, sure, I do believe that grief has a process. Like everyone always talks about the process of grief. But the most important thing that I learned is that I have some certain habits that go along with that. And I think anger is part of that, that sure. I started to get very angry. And I did that because I think that the whole time from age 15 to 29, the 14 years that I was in active addiction, there were points in my life where I had opportunities to grieve. Mm-hmm. But I think that the bottle, it completely negates any opportunity for growth within yourself, whatever that is, mental, spiritual, whatever. And the lesson that I learned was that I had a part of me that was underdeveloped and that was completely outmatched by this. And so for anyone in early sobriety, I think that we have to be realistic. My message to anyone would be, grief is inevitable, whether it's someone dying or grief of something else, grief and loss of any type. It is an experience that is, I think, that is guaranteed in life, and especially in sobriety.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had seen it enough, even in my early sobriety, the year and a half, I'd heard the stories and I'd seen a few people where there was a reservation in place. If so-and-so dies, then I'll start drinking again. Mm-hmm. Or I don't know what will happen. I don't have a contingency or whatever. I think that's a part of the work that we have to do when we're working with sponsors, when we're looking at various aspects of the steps, specifically our work in step four. We need to be able to see patterns from our past, and we need to be able to look deep within to see where reservations lie.
Yeah.
What are we holding out for? What has happened in our past, and how can we prepare ourselves for what might happen? Because spiritual conditioning is a huge part of the program. And I think that sometimes we hear it a lot, but we don't understand what that really means. And for myself, I had to walk through grief. I got spiritual conditioning by walking through this grief. And the only way that I did that was I dedicated myself to service. Mm-hmm. So for 2 whole years during the grief and after, as in anticipating those folks dying. And afterwards, I was surrounded by AA folks so often.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people that were of service, and they were showing me the way. And that was a key part of this, that giving back to the program was a key part of this, and learning about how to give back was a key part to this, because that provided me some spiritual conditioning. It isn't just about spiritual growth on my own, you know, some sort of routine that I have. That's good. But what's worked best for me is, again, being around people that are going to hold me accountable to the growth that I'm experiencing in that moment. Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No. So what did you kind of discover in that? Because you had mentioned the kind of going deep into ourselves, you know, into the spiritual conditioning. What in particular did you find that you didn't know what was there?
I think what I discovered was that it was okay for me to let the dam break emotionally.
Okay.
So I think that so often I don't want to show what's going on inside. And that was always like a repetitive thing with me where, you know, hey, what's going on in your head and in your emotions, you're not showing them. You're always just stern-faced. You know, you look pissed off, Seth. That's what I always heard, that you look pissed off. You look pissed off. Yeah. And sometimes we see that with people when they come into the program, people like me that we're holding stuff in. People do it for years in this program. And I'm an example of that, that I was just holding back the anger that I had, that people have to die in this world, that just the fact of the matter is that sometimes people have quick and you know, relatively quick, I mean, like the period of 11 months, but it was very fast for me, and they were gone. And I had two people that were close to me, my mom and another person in the program. Then they were grieving, you know, and their lives had completely changed. And I was completely powerless over it. And it all came, a lot of it came back to step one. And it's hard to hear that people say, you know, part of this is working step one. Like, you have absolutely no power over what has happened to them. You can only manage your emotions and your behavior and how you're reacting to it right now. And so that's what happened, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. A big loss of my life was my father when I was, 18 years sober. And like you said, that was the one thing I would drink over. Right. And I didn't, but, I had to surround myself with people, to take care of me. It was this point of where, oh, wow, I can't take care of myself right now. Mm-hmm. I really have to rely on other people. And one of the things that came out of that for me too was my friend Nick, who had lost his father, I'll say 20 years prior. We were all 21, and his dad died of prostate cancer. And and I always wondered kind of what, you know, life was like for him without his dad and everything. And then it was happening to me, and he was one of the people who was supporting me. And we were just sitting at the hospital, because it was a waiting game for my dad. And it was just me and him. And he said, I want to let you know something. He says, people are going to tell you, you know, it's okay. And he says, it's never okay. I just want you to understand it. Well, it's never okay that your dad's gone. He says, you'll be okay one day. But I just, you know, he just said, I want to give you permission to not just wash this over like, oh, it's okay, it's okay. You know, time heals all wounds. He says, some don't. Okay. And you know, and he's talking from 20 years experience, right? And he says, it's better, but it's never okay. And so that was a kind of a gift for me, because I needed something to not whitewash it away, like you were saying, where it's like, I got to share with people. Like, are you upset still? Sometimes, yeah. Yeah. You know, I have a wife and son that my dad's never met, and I wish he did. Okay? Mm-hmm. That's not okay. Mm-hmm. I understand it. I'm living with it. I'm not creating spiritual disruption in my life because of it, but I wish he would have met them, you know. So that was a gift for me from my friend Nick, and hopefully other people out there can get that as well.
And one thing that happened next for me was, then I found that, like, this grief thing, I thought I wasn't doing it right, you know. Like, I was really scared that, yeah, you know. And I'd just chosen a profession to be a clergy person, and we're supposed to have some authority on grief and understanding and be able to explain what's happening for people when someone mm-hmm. dies. We're also supposed to be in hospital rooms when people die. And I was supposed to, part of my training was to do a 3-month internship as a chaplain in a hospital. And that's when fear set in for me, really.
Sure.
And the next real trajectory in my sobriety was gaining enough confidence to walk through all of those things. So, you know, I started seminary right after my stepfather passed away, you know, the September after my the spring of when my stepfather mm-hmm. passed away, and I really held off on doing that chaplaincy internship for 2.5 years, and people were wondering, like, what's going on, and I didn't want to admit that, you know, I was completely terrified by how my mind and body reacted and my emotions reacted to the two deaths, the first two deaths that I experienced in sobriety. So I needed to do some more work before I got there. And I needed to, I think I really needed to understand more. I think that the point is that I needed to know more about the God of my own understanding. You know, I needed to discover a little bit more about that.
I think that
in the rooms we talk a lot about that, but on a personal level, when we talk to sponsor and when we talk to close friends in sobriety, myself as a spiritual person and a clergy person in AA, I recommend that talking to people about a well-defined understanding of how you understand higher power mm-hmm. is going to serve you quite well in the way that you understand the things that are coming your way in life in the future, you know? So I started to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, it's like laying another foundation. Like, you have the first one that's mm-hmm. solid, and then, there's more. There's like a new level where the God of your understanding, there's a shift in that. And the God that I thought was going to help me through this phase of my life, I didn't know yet.
Yeah.
And I lost a little bit of faith in that. Like, well, can God help me through this go through that whole thing again? And the trust and the, you know, the belief and acting as if all that. And you go through phases of that as you gain years of sobriety where I've questioned my faith and I don't know if I can trust God on this. And turns out I can.
Yeah. I really hear that a lot from people. And the best thing I can say to anyone who's questioning their faith is that it is a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, to have doubts, it doesn't mean that you're doing anything wrong spiritually. To have doubts means that you are engaged in spiritual discovery and you're currently on the path, moving forward, progressing. You know, that is the major value of discovery in this program, right? Because you started at that one point. For myself, it was looking at those 12 steps on the wall and being like, none of that's for me. And now here I am, you know, I'm preaching every Sunday to a congregation. I never thought I'd be doing that, right? Yeah. So it shows that there is a weaving and winding path that we are promised to be able to step if we just take it one day at a time, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think those doubts come from some open-mindedness as well. You know, it's not just about doubting in belligerence. And it's doubt in the sense of, I need some more information here. I need to ask a few more questions or ask people a little more about their experience and try to maybe even borrow someone else's understanding of God for a little while and see if that works for me. It's okay. Yeah. It's okay.
Yeah. And that is so valuable to me too. When I hear another person's perspective, it only adds to me. If I've borrowed something, like it has enriched the lenses that I use to see the world through, to glean meaning out of the world. And so for myself, you know, I was looking at the fear of what's it going to be like when I'm going to have to explain to people that have lost someone in the, in the ER, right?
Sure.
At 3 years in, that was just absolutely terrifying. And I slowly worked my way through building my spiritual understanding as I studied in seminary, built up skills and knowledge. At that time, I was offered a position as a support worker at a treatment center. And there I was working with chaplains in the 12-step environment, working with clients. And, you know, of course I stepped in there and I wanted to control all the patients in the treatment center that I went to. And I wanted them to do the program in the exact way that I did and have the same awakenings and do things. And it just ended up not working. And people said, you got to change the way you work with people. You need a completely different approach. And in about 2.5 years, I think that things clicked. And that's that community part of higher power, where I started learning from other people how to stop controlling people and let them come to me and let them, you know, let God work through me and to listen first, you know. And then time came where I needed to go in and step in to do this 3-month internship at a hospital. And they bill this is going to be 10-hour days. Sometimes you'll be working 24 hours straight. And I absolutely embraced it. And, it feels like there's so much AA in chaplaincy training, and it's so weird because the guy who ran the program said, and it's run by clergy, he goes, yeah, a lot of people from AA when they come through here, and, you know, clergy people that are in AA, they identify with it a lot. Mm-hmm. And really the structure of chaplaincy training, which is called clinical pastoral education, is you're brought in, you're given a week-long crash course, and then they just start sending you out into hospital rooms for visits.
Wow.
And there's always this process where you come back into a room with your peers and you sit in a circle and then you just share. So there's a huge component that is just sharing. And then when we started doing that, then I was like, okay, I can see the connection here, because it did feel a little bit like a meeting at times.
Sure.
You know, people would be sharing their experiences and sharing their past and relating it to their experience in the room and how their biases and how they perceive the world and how they perceive higher power is actually in impacting how they deal with a patient in the moment. And so the interesting thing is I was put on call for my first shift, and they give you a pager. And I said, well, we'll see what happens. I had to sleep at the hospital. So I got off shift at 4:00, and I was then on call. And I went to go get food, and I'm like, okay, is this pager going to go off? What's going to happen here? And I was a little bit nervous. And I'm like, it'll go when I'm eating dinner. I bet it's going to go. And it didn't. I said, well, this is going to be good. Then I'll just go back to the room. I'll get to sleep early, and I'll be ready for tomorrow's shift at 7:30 a.m. And as I'm walking down the hallway, the pager goes off. And the first call that I got on a pager was a drug overdose.
Oh.
And again, what is God doing? What is God doing to me? So I put my bag back into the office where my bed is, and I run down, and there we go. We got a chaplain from the fire department in with the family already. And he switches off with me and says he's done. And I'm in the family room for about 1.5 hours. And the neurologist comes in with the bad news that the person is effectively brain dead and is on life support. Hmm. And this is the first call. First time.
Yeah. Thanks for trusting me, God. Thanks. Yeah.
My palms were sweating, and I was holding on to my hand. But something in me at that time told me to take charge. Like, I knew what to do. I've been told what to do. I've listened, and I can go on instinct on this. You're prepared for this moment. You've spent enough time preparing for this moment. Again, spiritual conditioning, putting in the work before, and then suddenly this moment presents itself for you. And so what I did was I said, I'm going to excuse myself. Things were taking a little bit long. And I went in, I talked to the doctor. He didn't have much information for me because I was like, what are they waiting for? They've been told by the neurologist that their loved one is on life support,
yeah,
and that they have to make a decision. And this one doctor was not very helpful. I found another doctor. I found the respiratory therapist. I talked to them all. I said, the family's waiting. What's going on? We need to give them some more clarity, because the neurologist was pretty terse. Like, mm-hmm, all he just said, he just dropped this bomb in there and they're trying to make sense of it. They don't even know that they have a responsibility.
Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, in my training, they said, sometimes as a chaplain, you need to do that. You need to be an advocate for the families. And that's ended up that, and I'm a student chaplain. It says intern chaplain on my, you know, on my,
so they know you're new. There's no doubt.
Yeah. They know I'm new. I'm like, and so eventually it got to the point where I'm in the room with the patient who's hooked up to life support. The respiratory therapist is standing there ready to take them off. Yeah. The nurse is there, and the nurse says, he's right. We need to go in there and clarify and make sure that the family knows. So the family then had to go through this hour and a half long process, after which, when doctor comes in and says, it is time, you have to decide if she's going to go to ICU for an extended period of time, and we'll keep her there. That is an option, or we can remove her from life support. And they left, and I spoke with them for a while, and I said, there's some things that we're going to need to do. If you pray, this is the time to pray. If there's anything that you need to do to remember her, let's go into the room and do that now. But we don't have much time. Yeah. And they went, they removed a lock of her hair, and the family prayed with me numerous times. And we stayed there, and then a family member made the call, and he said, yeah, we can remove her. And we all held hands, and I said, it's okay. You can hold her hands. You can place a hand on her, because she will be passing on to the afterlife, and that's okay. But just for yourself, you need to remember this to be there. And it happened. It wasn't pretty. It's not like it is in the movies. Sometimes it's not pretty, and it was not.
Yeah, where they cough and they, you know, they fight, yeah, for their life. Yeah, I know.
Mm-hmm. But they were with me, and I stayed with them for 45 minutes. I walked them to their car. It was 11:30 at night. So for 4 hours I was with them, and that changed my life. It really did. And I was prepared, and I didn't know I was prepared. Mm. I think that that's sometimes a lesson that people need to know in the program, is that you can put work in the program, and sometimes you don't know that it's working until the moment that it happens, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. The, we talk about the spiritual conditioning, just a great way to frame things up, where, you know, in a moment of time, you don't think you have it in you. It's like, well, you've been preparing for a long time for this very moment. It doesn't, you know, it seems like a snapshot, but, you know, in the timing of my recovery or God's eyes, it's not. This is the moment I've been preparing for. And, you know, to hear that from, you know, the transition you have now from when you first were talking and said, you counted how many times the word God was in the steps, and you just weren't comfortable with that. And, you know, what a transition, what an incredible gift you've given yourself, and, yeah, and, you know, and all the support from your family and everything. And just, it's all just come full circle for you. It's great. It's great stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'd like you to explain to the audience about some of your amends. You know, one you had mentioned when we done some of the background information with your parents. Can you talk more about that, please?
Yeah. When I got into sobriety and when I first came to the program, The two biggest amends were with my father and with my mother. Mm-hmm. And they're divorced. And one of the big parts of that amends, I mean, I really unfairly used that divorce as a manipulation tool. Mm-hmm. And I was really nasty with that. And
how old were you when they got divorced?
17.
Okay.
So they were talking about separation for about 2 years and not separating. That's an unfair experience. It's not a great experience. But as we learn in the program and what I learned, which is, I'm really glad I learned this lesson, is that bad things like that can happen, but I still have a responsibility to look at my own behavior, mm-hmm. as it relates to that issue.
Yeah.
And so when I started, you know, working on my fourth and fifth and looking at all that stuff around the divorce, then I had, you know, a little bit of a realization about what my part in making that so uncomfortable was. And I realized that, yeah, I really held on to a resentment really way too long. And also, you know, like I held on to it so long that it then fueled very aggressive and abusive behavior from myself to both of my parents. So some of the incidents that happened were, there were periods where they were attempting to get me into psychiatric care. They were working together, even though they were divorced adults, and I was their adult son. And I was threatening, I was screaming, police were involved, they sacrificed a lot of their own mental health and their own physical health in the process of worrying and trying to care to get an adult into psychiatric care. And not just one time. Like I said, I was hospitalized 4 times. And part of the amends process in working 8 and 9 was looking at how I was responsible for a whole system of behavior, for a whole system of unhealthy, manipulative, and aggressive and abusive behavior. And the later part of my step work, when I finally got down to look at that and to work and see my part, what was important was that I eventually got to the point where I completely was able to take ownership over this and to see what was at the root of this. And I saw my part. That was important. I didn't expect their response to be the way that it was.
What did you expect?
I expected a lot more fanfare.
Okay.
I thought, you know what? I guess it must have been ego, but I did expect them to expected some congratulations, you know, I really did. I expected a little bit more recognition for me making the amends. I think that, I had a lot of expectations going in. I was very nervous. So I went to go visit family back in Vancouver, and I did this knowing that I was going to make an amends. So what I did was I had dinner with my mom, and this was when my stepfather was still with us. And I said, you know, the reason why I'm here to have dinner with you guys is I've been doing a lot of work on myself, and I've looked at how abusive I was over the last 14 years and how extreme things got, and the numerous occasions where I was acting very inappropriately, and how much I scared you and how much this taxed you and the cost that it's had in your life. And I'm working hard to look at that, and I'm in a process of change, and I'm working at this every day. And they had a one sentence response that, we're very proud of you and we're happy that you're sober. And I was like, that's it. I was very happy to hear that.
Yeah. That's nice, but that's it.
Yeah, great. You know, and I just was like, great. Then an immense sense of relief overcame me, you know. And so with my father, same exact thing. I sat down for dinner. I got to the point where I had enough courage to say what I had to say, what I had written down, what I'd prepared with my sponsor. And it was acknowledged in one sentence. But in reflection on that, the amount of happiness and the amount of gratitude that the two of them, really, both my mom and my dad, who I had so much to think that, you know, so much, like they had forgiven me.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I didn't really know that. Sorry, my dogs are being a little playful right now. Okay. So, they had, my dad absolutely had forgiven me. It was without any question, the amount of relief. They'd already seen the work that had been done. I think that was the key to all this, that they saw in me a change, and they saw it so quickly. That's how quickly the steps in the program, when you see that happen to a newcomer, it's an amazing process. And I think they saw that in me and were finally relieved that all the 14 years of worry were slowly drifting behind them in the past, really.
Now, yeah. Do you think their lack of affect was about, all right, yeah, we know, or what do you think it was about?
I think part of it was that, we've lived this. We were there. Maybe you weren't, but we were there. But the biggest thing that I've seen in them, and I think that what it really has to do with, is their absolute relief. Hmm. I think that they feared for my life for so many years, a decade and a half, and the fact that they had to intervene, get me into hospital, do welfare checks. They had to call around to find out where I was when my phone was disconnected. Mm-hmm. When that finally stopped, their lives could begin again.
So really. It's like one giant exhale for them, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So what I'd like to do now is have you talk about, you mentioned in some of the background information, you have a reoccurring problem.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So, I have a reoccurring issue whenever someone who is popular, well-liked, whenever someone is gregarious and is a big personality and is an extrovert. And, this happens a lot in the program, but also in my professional life, I am threatened by them and I build resentments against mm-hmm. them. And, so this happened when I first was hired on at a treatment center. There were obviously people that had progressed further in the organization than myself, and were their opinion was respected, and they could tell people, including me, what to do. Mm-hmm. And so what happened was I began to speak with colleagues that were at my same level, and we began to... they began to criticize my behavior, in a constructive way. They were saying, Seth, this is not going to serve you well. You know, you talking behind someone's back. That's not very spiritual, is it? So, So what would happen is, exactly what I've talked about as a struggle in my life is, deep down, I would start to build up some anger against individuals. Mm-hmm. I would get frustrated, and things would start coming out sideways. And so things would come out sideways, really in other parts of my life professionally. Mm-hmm. So working with people who are not even related to the whole issue, I was dumping my bad, negative anger, whatever it was, on them. And so people were saying, like, what's going on with you? Like, what's the source of all this, really? Why are you treating other people this way? Why are you treating people who are newer to the organization, who are coming in that need training and things like that? Why is this happening? And honestly, what I really believe is this program is a program where we develop blind spots. And I think it's important for us to know that. The process of having the steps and continual attendance at meetings, and the process of having a sponsor and listening to other people speak, like going to a meeting and listening to another person speak, the reason why, that's a chance for some self-reflection, self-evaluation to get some other people to look at your side of the street and to see what's going on, because it's very hard for me to clean up my own mess and for me to see what's going on with me, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You remind me of and just triggered as you were talking, because again, that whole sideways thing, they're indirectly hurting others. One of my character defects that's keeps reoccurring is I have the tremendous capacity to hurt the innocent. And what I mean by that is, like you said, people who aren't even related to a situation, right? And by the way, I can say that sentence pretty easily to you now, but that wasn't something that was easy to say for a very long time. Mm-hmm. And I teach high school. And I teach chemistry and physics and personal finance. And I was asked 1 year to teach the AP physics class. And I said, sure, I'll give it a try. And they said, we're going to send you to AP physics course on how to teach it. You know, it's a little more advanced than, you know, honors. I said, okay, sounds great. And I went from typically being the smartest person in the room when it came to physics to being the dumbest person in the room when it came to physics. I'm sitting in this room. Mm-hmm. And everybody has been doing this longer, has more background, I am literally the newest guy in the room, but perhaps one of the oldest people in the room, if you follow what I'm saying. And I'm afraid to ask questions because they're talking about expressions that formulas I should know and I don't know. Mm-hmm. And I got connected with someone and I just kind of became his little sidekick and listened to everything he had to offer. And, you know, he became my mentor in this situation. And I just kind of came clean with him. I said, I'm having trouble being here because I'm the dumbest person in the room. And he said, yeah, but you made it in the room.
Oh.
And I was like, oh, I got it. He's like, yeah, he says, you don't think I was the dumbest person in the room at one time?
Mm-hmm.
You know, or I thought I was, you know, and it's like, oh, yeah, so we all start from the beginning. We all start crawling. None of us start walking. And again, I'm 27 years sober or something and not grasping on because the ego, you know, is still in charge sometimes. And, you know, and I was coming home and in a bad mood and, you know, said, oh, this course sucks. And I mean, it was just, I was like a child, you know, a high school student, really. Just understand what they go through. I don't understand it. So the teacher must be stupid, right? Yeah. And all that stuff. So I'm really glad that he leveled me in the sense that, none of us think you're supposed to be the top one in here. We know you're new. And it's like, wow, it's okay. Yeah. It's okay. So, or you were talking about stand-up comedy. Like, you know, I'm not the funniest guy in the room. Wait a minute, hold on, you know, I'm not the best at this. I'm not the best. Nope, you're not. It's okay. We're all, you know, there is no finish line to be the funniest guy in the room or the smartest. There's no finish line for that. Mm-hmm. It's an infinite game. We just keep playing it for the sake of playing it so that we can all help each other get better. That's all it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things we had talked about prior to the interview was what it's been like in the last year with COVID and meetings and recovery for you. Can you talk a little bit more about that for us?
Yeah. So both in my work and in recovery, you know, when March rolled around last year, it was obvious that I wasn't going to be doing in-person worship services as a pastor, and that I couldn't go to my AA meeting, which is four blocks from my house. And at the same time, at that very moment, then I started using Zoom. And So emails were being thrown around my home group. And I said, well, yeah, I'm doing the weekly online service for and coffee hour for my church. And I'm kind of working through how to do that online. And so, yeah, why don't we just, you know, I can help the group out that way. And they said, sure. And so the very next week, you know, we didn't skip a single meeting. We had people signed on, and it's a speaker meeting. It's a Friday night meeting that normally has 55 people or so, 55 to 70 people on any given night. And it started off where there was about, you know, 30 people, and word got around. We were the only meeting in town doing this. And we started helping other meetings doing it. And now it's turned into a larger regional meeting, which has been really good for people, is that we're in Kingston, Ontario, 3 hours east of Toronto. And now we're starting to have a regular amount of individuals, because Toronto currently right now is still on lockdown and has been since prior to Christmas. And those folks have been relying on our meeting, and the group has grown close.
Just so the audience understands, when you say lockdown, people can't go anywhere. Like here in the US, like I can go to the grocery store. You know, we have some in-person meetings.
It means that only essential services are open in Toronto. Yeah. We have much stricter, regional lockdowns, and we had a month lockdown for the entire province of Ontario. Mm-hmm. And that was the second lockdown that we've had, so we've gone through some very, very strict processes. So what this has meant is that my home group, which is kind of the Friday night group that everyone goes to hear a speaker speak, has been meeting virtually for an entire year. We have reopened as a virtual meeting, as a hybrid meeting. We reopened as a hybrid meeting only yesterday.
That was the
first time since. So that was a full 12 months of no in-person meetings for anyone in this home group. Wow. With a home group of over, you know, of over 40 people as membership. Yeah. And we've held all of our business meetings online. We've done we've had special business meetings. We started a committee that I said we need to strike a reopening committee so that we do this appropriately, so that we work with the health region and everything. Again, in a time, COVID, where I knew that stress was going to be happening, just like other times in my life, I knew that AA service was going to be a major part of carrying me through this, because it's one thing for me to be a part of the meetings, but it's another thing for me to be actually involved helping other people and getting in. And the best part, the absolute best part of service, is that you start meeting people that are super, super serious about regular meeting attendance and helping out others.
Yeah.
You know, that's where I've been able to get the best knowledge from people, when we start talking recovery, when we're not involved in service stuff. And there's a level of respect and camaraderie that I get from people who I do service work with, where I just get more intimate and closer to them. And I have higher stakes in their life and in their sobriety. Along this process, completely online, through Zoom chat, I've been able to get two sponsees. Mm-hmm. People saying, hey, what's up? How you doing? I'm new. I didn't think this was possible at all.
Yeah.
When this happened, like, I just remember back to the beginning of my recovery, you know, some people were like saying like, hey, yeah, this is like 10 years ago. People are saying like, yes, I go on these recovery websites I go to online meetings.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I was always like, psh, online meetings, man, those don't work. That's not real. That's not a real thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But heck, it's worked out. I'm now at step 10 with two sponsees, and we're running a Zoom online step group every Tuesday night, and I'm super close to these two guys, and I really am amazed that the best case scenario has happened regarding my sobriety in the time of COVID. Really, I think so. Yeah.
Excellent. I would also like you to, I had asked you about a book that has enhanced your recovery outside of AA literature. You gave me a few of them. Could you pick one to tell us about that we can highlight?
Yeah, absolutely. So very interesting for myself. I am a former stand-up comedian.
Yep.
That has become a pastor in recovery. And I thought that was pretty unique. And my dad kept saying, you know, you should read this book by this pastor. This female pastor's name is Nadia Bowles Weber, and it's called Pastrix. I had no idea about anything about her, but my dad kept saying, check her out. Then I started reading her blog a little bit, and then he sends me her book that she had just published. And I got around to reading it eventually, and then I was like, wait a second. She's a former stand-up comedian that has become a pastor, and it outlines her whole story about going through recovery, and she's in recovery as well. And I was like, this is like, I can relate to this so much because it talks about her life before, and it was very similar to my life. It talks about her life, entering into early sobriety. And then it talks about her process, which, I mean, like I talked about my chaplaincy training. She has a few chapters on what that's all like as well. Amazing. So if you want to hear the experience of, coming to believe really in a book that's outside of the program, I think Pastrix is probably one of the better books that can talk about a process of coming to believe for someone who grew up completely with no spiritual background, which is what she did, she experienced. And for someone who was experimental, spiritually in their addiction, and then got sober and found a completely new way of life, which then ended up being a huge part of her identity in recovery. That book is completely invaluable to me. Like it is guided my thinking in my life, and it's been incredibly inspirational to me.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Look forward to checking that out sometime. And before we wrap things up, I'd like you to share with the audience about your YouTube channel. I know that's something that we talked about a little bit, and I think the audience would benefit from that. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, you know, this fall, you know, with spending so much time online, and doing so much video and you know, I was producing videos for my work, and I just said, you know, you're a former comedian, you're comfortable in front of the camera. I think that I specifically have something to offer individuals who want to talk about sobriety and experience sobriety in the digital space. And so I decided to start my YouTube channel where I walk people through addiction, recovery, and spirituality in a completely open-minded format where I encourage people to be on their own path and their own process. I don't promote one specific spiritual path. I really focus on people finding their individual and unique spiritual path, which is the way that I've worked as a chaplain in the past, which is the way that I work as a clergy person who is, you know, someone who identifies as a clergy person in the program, someone who does fourth and fifth steps with people. It's all about the individual and not dictating the way that the big book says you should be doing it. It's an exploration through the big book as it is revealed to you.
Oh, that sounds great. And where could they find this? I mean, I'll put it in the show notes, but where could they find it?
Yeah, you can find me on YouTube. It is under my full name, Seth Perry. Okay. So you can find me there. That's where I'll be. Or you can connect with me through Instagram at veganpastor1.
Okay.
Yeah.
Excellent. So before we go, is there anything else that you'd like to discuss? Anything you'd like to use the platform that perhaps I didn't get to?
No, I just really think that I think what's really important in what we've talked about is that we may not know that the program has prepared us for something when we talked about spiritual mm-hmm. conditioning today. And I think it's really important that people know that if you're new in the program, you're putting in the work to prepare yourself for something down the road, even though we're living in the day, living in each 24-hour period of our lives in sobriety. But, and it might not feel like you're being prepared. Like you might think the day is a complete write-off. That most likely is untrue, because even if it feels like you've failed, that failure actually might be a wonderful lesson.
Thank you very much. I think that's a great place to stop. And I want to, again, thank you for the experience, for coming on the show and making the connection that you did and contacting me. So thank you.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much.
We have come to the end of this episode of the Seasons of Sobriety podcast. I trust that you were able to identify with the personal story of our guest and perhaps apply some of their experience to give you the hope needed to persevere through your own journey. If you'd like to contact the show, please send an email to podcast@seasonsofsobriety.com. The email address can be found in the show notes. This podcast has been completely self-funded. If you believe today's episode has been beneficial, I ask that you either contribute a little extra this week to your home group or another organization close to your heart. Until next time, remember, if you have trouble practicing the principles of the steps in all your affairs, you may have too many affairs.